This is Truth Decay Part 2. If you were not here last Sunday, I said I would love to take credit for the title. I cannot. It's my nominee, though, for Best Book Title of 2018. It's the title of a study by the RAND Corporation, Research and Development Corporation, one of the most prominent public policy research corporations in America, did a study called Truth Decay, trying to figure out what's going on with the very idea of truth in America. Why is there not only conflict about what is true, but why is the very notion of truth itself under attack these days? How do we understand that? What can we do about it? So that's where the title comes from. Today, the part two is subtitled A Field Guide to Fallacies. I want to present you with a bestiary of bad reasoning so that you can go out into the field just like you could with your, you know, guide to trees or songbirds or whatever. You could actually go out in the field and search for these things in the wild. Many of these are not hard to find, as you will see. So that's what we're doing today. Let's begin, as always, with a prayer. Gracious God, we thank you. Thank you for this time together. We thank you for your word, which we take to be the truth that we know in Jesus Christ. And we thank you that you do not leave us forlorn in this world, but you come with the truth, the way, the truth, and the life. And Jesus promises that the truth will set us free. So open our hearts and minds to understanding. Help us to seek to know you truly, to follow you faithfully, to love you dearly. We ask in the name and for the sake of Christ our Lord. Amen. All right. A few sort of technical terms. I told you last time that I was a philosophy major, which I've been apologetic for ever since, but it turns out to be really helpful because philosophy is about thinking clearly. So a few terms. Some of these are terms that are used by philosophers just to sort of set the table here for our understanding. I want to begin with a distinction between assertions and arguments. An assertion is a truth claim, a declaration that something is the case. It's just somebody declares that something is the case, it may or may not be based on evidence. So, one might claim that Tom Brady is the best quarterback. Yeah, notwithstanding the fact that Tom Brady is evil, one might claim he is the best quarterback ever, right? And so that's an assertion, and you could debate that. You look for some evidence, you look at his stats, you look at all kinds of things. Another kind of assertion that is made, the moon landing was a hoax. If you think that's bizarre, it is bizarre, but people have in fact claimed that. The whole thing was staged in some theater somewhere out in the Southwest to make it look like the moon. So the essence of an assertion is it's simply a truth claim, a declaration made by somebody, which may or may not be based on evidence and therefore may or may not be true. An argument, by contrast, is a form of reasoning to a conclusion based on either premises or evidence. So you see the distinction. An assertion is Tom Brady's the best quarterback. Moon landing was a hoax. Somebody simply declares something. An argument is a line of reasoning to a particular conclusion, again, based on either premises or evidence. And there are two forms of argument, broadly speaking. Deductive, which tends to run from general premises to a particular conclusion, and inductive, which runs from particular evidence to a general conclusion. I'm going to give you examples of these in just a moment. So a deductive argument is necessarily true if the premises are true and the argument is valid. So the classic syllogism from the first day of logic class is all men are mortal. That's a major premise of the syllogism. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal, right? So the form of the argument is valid. Major premise, minor premise, conclusion. So the form is intact, and as long as the premises are true, the conclusion must be true. That's the nature of deductive reasoning. Now, if either premise is false, the conclusion will be false. So if you said, for example, all men are blind rather than mortal, the argument is valid in its form. All men are blind. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is blind. But the argument leads to a false conclusion because one of the premises is false. You see that? Not complicated at all. So the nature of deduction is the conclusion of a valid argument, and valid means the structure of the argument is right. The nature of deduction is that the conclusion of a valid argument will always be true if all the premises are true. Okay? Pretty straightforward. Inductive argument runs the other direction. from specific examples or evidence to some sort of general conclusion. The conclusion may be true, but the conclusion involves probability rather than deductive proof. Why does this matter? Science, for example, is largely inductive. How do scientists know stuff? They test things. They boil water, right? And turns out every time you boil water at 100 degrees centigrade at standard pressure, which is to say loosely at sea level, it boils. There's not a liberal boiling point of water or a conservative boiling point of water. It's just 100 degrees centigrade. How do they know that? Because every time they've done it, forever and ever and ever, it comes up with the same result. Now, is it conceivable? Is it conceivable that one day they could take the temperature to 100 and it wouldn't boil? I suppose. But the probability of that is vanishingly small. So the nature of science is largely inductive. It derives conclusions, including theories and laws, based on consistent evidence. A theory in science is not a hunch or a guess. And that's an important distinction, and this causes no end of confusion in some circles among Christians in this country. So he said, I have a theory that the Pirates are going to win this year. Well, first of all, you laugh. So I take your laughter to mean you suspect the evidence for that is not entirely compelling. We drop below 500. But it's my theory. And when I say that informally, I mean, it's kind of my hunch. It's my feeling. I might have reasons to believe that. You laugh. You don't think it's true. So when people in ordinary parlance talk about a theory, they mean it's kind of my hunch. It's my inclination. It's what I think. That's not what scientists mean when they talk about a theory. In science, a theory is a well-established explanatory claim consistent with all the known evidence, for example, the theory of evolution. So evolution is almost the fundamental theory of biology. Almost no practicing biologists do not believe in the theory of evolution. But there are some segments of American Christendom that say, well, you know, evolution's only a theory. And what they mean by that is, evolution is like, I think the Pirates are going to win this season, right? It's only a hunch. It's only somebody's impulse. That's not what scientists mean by a theory. A theory in science is a well-established explanatory scheme that is consistent with all the known evidence. If evidence should ever come to light that contradicts the theory, then, of course, the scientists would drop it. And that has happened from time to time. But it's important to make two observations here, that a large element of what we consider to be the truth isn't proved through logical deduction, but is rather inferred through a kind of inductive argument based on evidence. And it turns out that much of what we believe in this world is based on induction, including things that really matter to us. So in law, somebody pointed out to me after the discussion last time, that law, for example, is a high-stakes realm where you seek to know the truth, but the truth is only gained through induction by evaluating the evidence, right? By the way, the sign-up sheet's coming around. Please pass it all the way back on that side and then over to this side so we don't miss anybody. Okay? So there are high-stakes realms in our experience that are all about seeking the truth. But the truth isn't proved in the sort of deductive way. It's arrived at inductively based on the weight of the evidence. Some of you know that I was in a murder trial jury, five or six years ago. And a young man was accused of murder. He was charged with third-degree murder. The 12 of us in the jury had to decide based on the evidence, the guy guilty or not, and it's high stakes. A young guy would go away for probably 12 or 20 years, third degree, not first degree. And so this is a high stakes thing. Do we have proof in the deductive sense? No, of course not. But there was evidence. Prosecution presented their evidence, defense presented theirs. 12 of us had to decide. We made a decision. That's the way law works in, for example, criminal cases or even civil cases. What's the truth here? You weigh the evidence. And relationships, more routinely. We think that some people love us. We think our parents love us. We think our spouse loves us. We hope our kids love us, though the evidence for that is sometimes spare. We believe all kinds of things that are high stakes for us. They really, really matter. Whether people love us or not counts a lot. Do we prove that through some sort of deductive, logical reasoning? No, of course not. We sort of look for evidence. Are they nice to us? Do they treat us well? Are they appreciative? So the point being here that much of our quest for the truth is a kind of inductive process of weighing evidence and arriving at what strikes us as the most probable accounting for the evidence. And that's a key thing, probability. Much of what we believe is based on probability. Does my family love me? Yeah, I think the probability of that is pretty high. Are the Pirates going to have a winning season? Probability of that is less high. People make judgments based on their sense of the evidence and the probabilities. Okay, now, just a couple more technical terms, just because I never get to use the words ontology and epistemology. And so all that time studying philosophy, I just got to use the words whenever I can. In philosophy, ontology is about what is true, the way things really are. Is there a God or not? That's an ontological question. Does God exist or not? Is the world getting warmer or not? And any question that is a question of fact, a truth claim, is a question of ontology. Is this the case or is it not? But you'll quickly recognize that there's another question, which is, how can we know? Because there are lots of things that are true, but the question is, how do we know it? So the claim God exists is an ontological claim from ontos, Greek word for being. So if I say God exists, I'm making a claim about something that is real. Namely, God is real and God is out there somewhere or exists in some sense and isn't just a figment of my imagination. But it's a fair question to ask, well, how would you know that? And that's the question of epistemology. And philosophers spend lots of time on this distinction and trying to figure out how you know things. Pistis is the Greek word for faith or belief, and you see it right here in the root of the word epistemology. When we talk about faith in the Bible, the Greek word that's translated faith is pistis. And it means, you know, we have pistis in God, we have pistis in Christ. It means we believe in God, we believe in Christ, and we trust that God is real, that Christ is real. So we stake our lives on something that we believe to be the case. To believe something is to live as though it were true. I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. I believe that. That's an ontological claim. How do I know? Well, that's a fair question. We could talk about that with skeptics. But when I say I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, I'm making a claim that that is true. And when I say I believe it, that means I have a pistis, I have a faith, I have a trust that that's the case. That's what epistemology is about. How do you know these things? A key observation is that much of our life consists in believing things. Again, from the most obvious things. I set my clock for 5:30 in the morning so I can get up on Sunday and not fail to show up here, which would be bad. I trust that my clock is going to work, but I don't entirely trust it, so I set 2 clocks. And if it's really high stakes, I set 3 or 4 clocks. So, yes, I believe some things, but the degree of trust depends on probability, also depends on high stakes. I get in my car, I believe it's going to start. 99 times out of 100 it does. Once in a while, the battery's dead, right? Pick your examples. The sun came up every day for the last gazillion years. David Hume, a Scottish philosopher in the 18th century, famously said yes, but that doesn't prove that it will come up tomorrow. And it's a really interesting question in philosophy, how it is that we believe things that have always been the case, but don't necessarily have to be the case. There may be a day when the sun doesn't come up. Nevertheless, we live much of our lives believing things. Proof, strictly speaking, is limited to math and logic. This is a key point. People will sometimes say, well, you can't prove that God exists, therefore you shouldn't believe. No. If it's the case that most of what we believe is a sort of inductive reasoning from the evidence, then the fact that you can't prove something doesn't mean you shouldn't believe it. In fact, there's very little that we can prove. Strictly speaking, proof is a matter of mathematics or logic. Everything else is largely a matter of induction from the evidence. So it's always a fair question to ask, are our beliefs well-founded in reason and experience? Take a moment to look at this. There are things that are true, the blue square. There are things that I believe, the red square. They overlap, but they are not coterminous. Notice this is not to scale. There are many, many things that are true that I don't know. There are some things that I believe that may not be true, which is why this piece of the box hangs out here. The goal, of course, for truth seekers is to make as much of this box fit within this box as possible, right? But the point of the simple diagram is to say, what is true and what we believe are not necessarily coterminous. In fact, they're almost certainly elements here, things that I believe or that other people believe that are not the case. And even if this box was entirely within this box, there would be vast realms of things that we just don't know. Okay? Very simple diagram, but the point is important because people sometimes miss this. They say, well, I don't believe that that's true. I don't believe God exists. Well, that makes absolutely zero difference to the question of whether God actually exists. So people will say, I'm really mad at God because. I say, well, I don't believe in God. And they say that as if their not believing in God decided the question of whether God exists. To which one with a philosophy major and a gentle spirit patiently points out that those two things have nothing to do with each other. You may or may not believe that God exists. That has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that God exists or doesn't exist. But people always make claims as if what they believe settles the matter of what's the case. The truth to case study makes a big point of that. In our culture, where we have lots and lots of tribes and subcultures, which is our topic for next Sunday, people will say, well, I believe this, and my people believe this, and you believe that. Fine, that's true. But the fact that you believe it tells us absolutely nothing about whether what you believe is true or not. You have to look for the evidence that would answer the question, well, is this belief based on well-founded evidence or reasoning or not? Okay? So, what are the purposes of argument? Broadly speaking, there are two. One is to seek the truth. That's what I thought my first day of philosophy class, because they told us that's what humans do. Humans are the rational animals, and Aristotle said that the rational animal seeks the truth. That's our glory. That's what we're about. So for about a week, I believed that. One purpose of argument, and by argument I don't mean Tom Brady's the best quarterback. No, he isn't. Somebody else is the best quarterback. Not that kind of argument, not the food fight that people get into. By argument, I mean an inductive or deductive logical kind of reasoning. So one purpose of argument in that sense is to seek the truth, which is either valid reasoning from true premises to two conclusions. That's deductive reasoning. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. Or drawing legitimate inferences from the weight of the evidence. That's what we think of when we think of as the purpose of argument in this sense. By the way, some of you are fans of Charles Krauthammer. I saw his column yesterday. Anybody happen to see that? It's called I Had a Great Career and a Wonderful Life. Turns out he's been sick for many months. Now he says, my doctors tell me their best estimate is that I have only a few weeks left to live. So he describes how that's the case. And then here's the part that I want to share with you especially. He says, it basically says, I have no regrets. I'm glad I had a good life and so forth. But he's saying goodbye to all his readers. He says, I believe that the pursuit of truth and right ideas through honest debate and rigorous argument is a noble undertaking. I believe that the pursuit of truth and right ideas through honest debate and rigorous argument is a noble undertaking. I frequently have disagreed with Charles Krauthammer. On that claim, I absolutely agree. The pursuit of truth is noble. And in fact, often we understand the truth more fully and in a more nuanced fashion, precisely when we enter into respectful, reasonable conversation with people who see things differently. That's how we learn. If we only talk to people who agree with us, we never advance our understanding. If we sit down with people that see things differently and we say, I don't see it that way, tell me why you see it that way, that's what advances truth and understanding. So one of the purposes of argument in the sense we're talking about is to seek the truth, but another is to persuade, and these are not the same thing. To persuade is to get an individual or a group to believe or accept something. I want to persuade you that something is the case. And I'm going to give you a bunch of reasons in a moment why I might want to do that. Persuasion may or may not lead to true conclusions. Persuasion may be to true or false conclusions. And there's an ancient, at least as far back as Aristotle, there's an ancient study called rhetoric, which is the art of persuasion. Aristotle has a whole book on rhetoric. It is about persuasion, which is not the same thing as seeking the truth. People in positions of power and influence routinely seek to persuade. They may or may not be seeking to tell you the truth. In fact, sometimes persuasion is about keeping people from seeing the truth. So one purpose of argument is to seek the truth. Another is to persuade. Rhetoric is the classical art of persuasion. Rationalization is desire in search of reasons. I said last week that Reinhold Niebuhr, among many, many other people, said, reason is ever the desire, ever the servant of desire. Reason is ever the servant of desire. We have a word rationalization because we all know that there are things that we want, and then we have to persuade somebody, often ourselves, that that's a legitimate thing to want. That's why we have a word rationalization. So persuasion sometimes is to persuade other people of stuff, often, and I would argue frequently, even before we seek to persuade other people, we have to persuade ourselves. And that's what we call rationalization. And it's always easier to persuade those who want to be persuaded. So I'm trying to decide, should I buy this thing? A big, expensive thing. I really want to buy this thing. But maybe I shouldn't. It's expensive. And maybe my family won't like it. But it's really, really good. And so now, I find all kinds of reasons why it would be good to buy this thing. Perhaps you've heard people do this, right? You have no personal experience of this, but perhaps you've read about people that do this sort of thing. So I really, really want this thing, but now I have to come up with reasons to say why it's okay for me to do that. Well, the fact that I want it means I want to be persuaded, which means my bar for evidence is set fairly low, right? Which is why a judge in a court trial has to recuse herself or himself from a case in which a judge has an interest, right? So somebody sues Amalgamated Everything Corporation for violating some law. The judge has 1,000 shares of Amalgamated Everything. The judge cannot sit on the bench to hear that case. Why? Because the judge has an interest in the outcome. The difference between judges in court, most of the time, and what goes on between our own ears is that the prosecution, defense, and the judge are all located right here. The judge always has an interest in the outcome, which is why rationalization works. So, one purpose of argument is persuasion. It's easiest to persuade people that want to be persuaded. That's why human beings rationalize all the time, because prosecution, defense, and judge are all between our ears. What we want, we usually find a way to justify. Okay? That's very important. So now, motives to misrepresent the truth. We said last time that there are at least two ways to claim something that is false. One is to lie, and we define lying as a claim that the person making the claim knows is not true, right? That's sort of ordinary common sense understanding of a lie. I know that X is true, but I say not X. That's a lie, okay? I argue that more often than lying, people simply have mistaken beliefs. That's to say, I believe that A is the case, and I sincerely believe that A is the case. Turns out that A is not the case. I think for a bunch of reasons that we talked about last week, mistaken beliefs that are not lies are actually much more common than lies, because it takes a lot of work to lie. You got to hold cognitive dissonance in your head. You got to keep your story straight. You got to deal with the guilt feelings. There's a lot of reasons why lying is hard. Mistaken beliefs are really easy to hold, especially if they're about things that you want to believe, right? So what are some motives to misrepresent the truth, either through lies, which I want to argue are, compared to mistaken beliefs in general, relatively few. Lots of people lie about lots of stuff, of course. But even more common than lying is simply mistaken beliefs. What are some reasons, some motives? Money, not surprisingly. Follow the money, right? If I have something to gain financially from people not knowing the truth, then, of course, I have an incentive to misrepresent the truth, right? And it's not just that I need to persuade other people, it's that I need to persuade myself, right? So money is a key motivator. I don't even need to belabor that. People routinely misrepresent the truth if there's money at stake, right? Here's another one, roughly as common as search for money. People will say all kinds of stuff to get sex. Perhaps you've heard that. Lots and lots of novels are written about that. On my couch, which is my symbolic description for people that I have counseled with over the years. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard where somebody, usually but not always the woman, says, he told me, fill in the blank, and you can imagine the kinds of things that he probably said. No, I'm not married. My wife is terrible. If you knew my wife, you'd know that, you know, I shouldn't be with her. We're getting a divorce. You're beautiful. I must be with you. There are a million reasons that people misrepresent the truth in order to get sex. I don't need to belabor that, but it's absolutely a major motive. Power. That's another one. Money, sex, and power account for a whole lot of stuff. Perhaps you've noticed this. And power comes in all kinds of forms. Advancement, right? So the corporate rat race. I want to work my way up the ladder, so I take credit for stuff that actually my teammate over here did, but I want you to believe that I did it because I want to rise up the ladder, right? In my profession, that happens. If I'm seeking public office, perhaps you've noticed that once in a while, people will exaggerate things. If they're running from office, they'll say things that aren't entirely true. They'll misrepresent the facts in order to achieve a form of power, which is public office. And basically, any other interest that people have that is a form of power, that's a powerful motivation to misrepresent the truth, right? Money, sex, and power account for a whole lot of things. But also, this is a little more subtle, prior beliefs. We talked last time about confirmation bias and cognitive dissonance. People are inclined to admit evidence or data that are consistent with things they already believe, and conversely, inclined to discount evidence or data that are inconsistent with things that they believe. So, incentives or motives to misrepresent the truth include things that I already believe, right? I have a view of that group of people, and I've decided that that group of people is like this. And then along comes Jane or Joe, who sort of fits that group of people, but isn't like that. Well, Jane or Joe's the exception. Those people are still like that, right? In law, this is actually a principle, right? Stare decisis, stare decisis, however you say it, pronounced different ways. The Supreme Court and other courts have it as a matter of principle that in general, you want to avoid overturning prior opinions. Now, if the evidence or the circumstances change and you have to overturn a prior opinion, you do it. But there's a very strong resistance to do that for a very good reason, which is people need to believe in the courts. And you don't believe in the courts if one year they say, well, this is the case, and then next year a similar case is brought and they say, no, actually, we believe this, and they go back and forth. So this notion believing things or making pronouncements that are consistent with what we already have believed or said is actually a matter of principle in the law, and for a good reason. Cognitively, it's also a matter that operates in our own minds. Tribal loyalties. This will be the whole topic for next week, so I'll go light on this for the moment. But not surprisingly, if my tribe, and you can fill in anything you want for the nature of a tribe, if my tribe believes this, I've got lots and lots of motivations to believe it. And if my tribe thinks this is not true, I've got lots and lots of reasons to believe that something is not true. Again, that's the entire conversation for next week, so I'm going to go light on that for the moment. But it is a powerful screening mechanism for what people believe, and it's a powerful motive to misrepresent the truth if the truth is not consistent with what my tribe already believes or what I already believe. And finally, to avoid guilt. And this is no small thing. In my murder trial, you call on the defendant's best friend, and they always get up and say, they get sworn in, do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so I hope you got them. By the way, they say it that fast, you can't even understand what they're saying, and they say it so many times that clearly that's not being taken very seriously, right? Because you'll hear it 30 times in a day if they call 30 witnesses. And the purpose for swearing is to take seriously the idea that there might be a God, and you might pull one over on the judge or the jury, but you can't pull one over on God. So if you swear to tell the truth before God, you're acknowledging that God will get you and you can't fool God. I can tell you, having sat on a jury and having been in lots and lots of other circumstances, to avoid guilt in the sense of punishment, if you could go away for 20 years or 30 years or for life, the last thing you're going to quibble about is telling the truth, right? If you really did kill the guy, if you really did steal the money, if you really did do that horrible thing, you're probably not going to draw the line of moral compunction at telling the truth. So, to avoid punishment is an important motive for misrepresenting truth. That's a form of guilt, but there are others. Shame. I can't let myself believe this, because I'd be ashamed if that were the case. And so there are powerful incentives that we have in our own heads not to acknowledge that something is true because I would be ashamed. In fact, the old Book of English Common Prayer has a wonderful line that says, make us so grateful for thy mercies and afraid of thy judgments as would make us both afraid and ashamed to offend thee. I don't want to offend God because I'd be ashamed to offend God, and I don't want to incur the wrath of God. The Book of Common Prayer, 1929 Book of Common Prayer, I think, actually acknowledges this explicitly. The avoidance of guilt feelings and the avoidance of shame, a powerful incentive to misrepresent the truth. And, of course, guilt feelings, which is different from actual guilt. If the court finds you guilty, then you may do time in jail. You may get off the rap, but you might know you did it and you still feel guilty. There are lots of novels written about people that got away with the crime and the guilt eats away at them. It's a sort of a Dostoevskian theme, right? All right, so here's the field guide to fallacies. This is a bestiary of bad reasons. You could write this down. You could take it out to the field, and let's call the field, oh, say, television. And you could watch for these things to occur in the wild. And I can tell you most of these species are plentiful. So false assumptions, there are all kinds of examples. I put in simple little examples of most of these just to give you an idea of what we're talking about. So false assumptions. So I called somebody up. She didn't return my call. She didn't return my call because she hates me. This is a typical feeling that guys have when they're seeking a date, for example. Well, maybe she didn't return your call because she was busy. Maybe her sister showed up. Maybe she really did have to wash her hair that night. There are all kinds of reasons why somebody might not have done something, but we make false assumptions, either in the direction of inference to the cause or in the direction of conclusion, right? And people do this all the time. We have this sort of tendency to be paranoid about this, right? We have this tendency to imagine that if something didn't happen the way we wanted it to, it's because somebody doesn't like us or somebody's out to get us, right? To which there's the wonderful reply, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. Which is to say that your state of mind actually doesn't necessarily tell you anything about what's really going on. But we make all kinds of false assumptions, right? So that's one form of bad reasoning. The non sequitur. There are a bazillion of these. In this case, I picked something that has to do with longstanding conflicts. My grandfather and yours were enemies, so you and I must be enemies, right? We had a representative from Corrymeela, which is a peacemaking community in Northern Ireland when I was at the church in Carlisle probably close to 20 years ago. And so often the narrative is, I'm a Protestant, you're a Catholic, my people hate your people, why is that? Well, because your grandfather did this thing to my grandfather, right? The Middle East, yeah, pick your story. There are, and non sequiturs happen in all kinds of contexts, but a common one is, this bad thing happened to cause enmity, therefore we must be enemies, right? A typical function of peacemaking is to get people to set aside the non sequitur. Yes, it's true. Your grandfather killed my grandfather. My grandmother stole stuff from your grandmother. Yes, that's true. Let's not deny the facts. Does that mean you and I must be enemies? No, that's a non sequitur. It doesn't follow from what happened then to what we're doing now. And non sequiturs happen in all kinds of contexts. Overgeneralization. This is huge in our day. Those people. Those people. Right? And fill in any generic noun you want. I started with the easy ones, men. There's a lot of knowing laughter here. Yeah, what is that about? What is this knowing laughter over here? My daughter, God bless her, she's a wonderful, sensitive soul, and she's got a wonderful heart, and she collects friends that have had awful, awful things happen to them. Usually, the friends are women, and the awful stuff was done by men, right? And my poor daughter, she just absorbs this stuff because people find her out and they come to her. And she'll say once in a while, Dad, men are pigs. And I say, yeah? Yeah, a lot of them are. And the more I listen to the stories that she tells, the more I think, my God, and I don't mean that as profanity, I mean that literally. My God, how do you live with this? This is terrible. And then I say gently, we know, Anna, I'm a man, and your brother's a man, and your friend so-and-so are men, right? But it can be overwhelming, right? If you collect enough stories that are horrible things done by a group of people, just the mere collective noun can cause you to imagine that everybody in that collective noun, represented by that collective noun, does the kinds of things that 7 or 10 or 12 of your friends have experienced. And fill in the blank. Men, women, Muslims, Jews. Muslims brought down the World Trade Center, therefore Muslims are terrorists and want to destroy America. Really? There's 1.2 billion of them, and 19 of them were on those planes, right? But if you don't know any Muslims, and all you know is that Muslims, a collective noun, brought down the World Trade Center and hate America, because you heard Osama bin Laden say, you know, destroy all the American infidels. If you don't have any countervailing evidence for that, very, very easy to say, you know, Muslims are terrorists, they hate America, they can't be trusted. And by the way, this is not a hypothetical thing, after 9/11, after every time there's an incident involving Muslims, the FBI reports, a bunch of other places report, attacks on mosques, attacks on Muslims, all kinds of ethnically or religiously based attacks spike whenever somebody does something. Why? Because of overgeneralization. I could belabor this, I won't, you get the point. Straw man. Straw man is a very common thing. A straw man argument is one that exaggerates what the other person, it attributes a belief to the other person that the other person doesn't actually believe, so that you can knock it down. That's the idea of the straw man, right? Straw man you can knock over easily. So to attribute to somebody something that the other person doesn't believe, then you knock down the false belief, and you can claim that you've shown how stupid the other guy is, right? So here's an example. He thinks government can solve all our problems. This is not entirely hypothetical. I've actually heard somebody say this of somebody else. Well, I mean, on the face of it, government can solve all our problems is a manifestly stupid idea, right? I mean, who really thinks that? But in certain circles, you can say that, and you get away with saying that. You can usually get away with straw man arguments if the other person that you're accusing of the argument isn't present. That's an important point. If you're sitting around with five of your like-minded friends, and you're all of the same tribe, they say, those people think this. And everybody guffaws about how stupid those people are. Well, what's conspicuously absent from that conversation is any of those people, right? And fill in the blank. This happens all the time. People surround themselves with like-minded friends. Not surprisingly, they listen to news and information sources that tell them what they already believe. That some of those news and information sources, those people hate whatever. These people believe this. And everybody guffaws and says, yeah, aren't those people stupid? Well, you notice that doesn't happen if those people, if the best and brightest of those people are actually on the program or actually in the conversation. Straw man is huge, it's easy, it's cheap, and it's a logical fallacy. Ad hominem. This is against the man, right? Some of these are so old, by the way, they have Latin names. The ad hominem argument is you can't believe him, he's a fill in the blank. He's a liberal, he's a conservative, he's a Democrat, he's a Republican, he's a Muslim, he's a Jew, he's a whatever. You can't believe him because he's a this. It's not about the substance of the argument, it's about discounting whatever somebody says because that person fits some group that you want to discredit, right? I put in brackets over to the side if you can see it, but 2 + 2 = 4 even if Hitler says it. That's a really, really important point. People will use ad hominem arguments, give people names, for example, describe them with labels, write off whole groups of people, caricature with sort of playground name-calling. People will do that all the time precisely to avoid the substance of arguments. If I can dismiss anything that person says because he's a this or she's a that, then I don't have to take seriously what the person says. Qualification is, even if Hitler says 2 + 2 = 4, I think we'd all agree Hitler's a horrible man, 2 + 2 = 4, right? The point being, you can't dismiss the substance of somebody's claim simply by calling the person a name or labeling the person. This, perhaps you've noticed, goes on all the time too. There's more. I've got 3 pages of these, by the way, and these are not at all exhaustive. The U2 or the tu quoque. This is so old it even has a Latin name, U2. What about this? All right, so I catch you in a lie. And I say, yeah, you lied about that. And you say, yeah, but you lied about this. What about that? Well, yeah, okay, but you still lied, right? Tu quoque, you two, what about? Oh, I hear this all the time. All the time I hear this. these people did a bad thing.
Oh, yeah?
Well, those people did a bad thing. And tribal arguments often go this way. So let me ask you, if it's bad if somebody from that tribe lies, steals, misrepresents the truth, has adulterous affairs, or has conflicts of interest, if those things are bad, how do those things stop being bad if some people in this tribe do the same things? How does that work? I mean, just to lay it out, you see how illogical it is. But ask yourself, how often do you hear this? And it's really just a way of changing the subject, right? So somebody gets busted, this person lied, this person stole, that person had an affair, whatever. Oh yeah? Well, that person did it. As if that addressed the moral substance of what the other person did, and as if, didn't our moms all tell us, two wrongs don't make a right? Right? Johnny took a cookie. Oh yeah? Well, Susie took a cookie too. So does Johnny get off because Susie took the cookie? No, they both get grounded, right? Didn't our moms tell us two wrongs don't make a right? It's astonishing how frequently grown-ups use essentially, oh yeah, well she did it too. As if that was an argument for dismissing some bad claim about somebody else, right? All the time we hear that. That's so old, by the way. The rhetoricians of ancient Greece and Rome talked about it. That's why they call it tu quoque, which is just Latin for, yeah, well you too. You lied. Yeah, well you too. Tu quoque. Both sides cheat. As if both sides cheating was okay, right? If it's bad that they cheated, why is it okay that we cheat? Because they cheated. That's just nuts. Half-truths. Guns don't kill people, people kill people. We're going to talk about this again next week. It astonishes me how many people are persuaded by that claim. Now, there's an element of truth to it. If by guns don't kill people you mean guns don't leap off the shelf and shoot up a room full of concert goers, well, duh, yes, of course, that's true. On the other hand, if you want to argue that guns have nothing to do with shooting up a room full of concert goers, or more specifically, let's say from 32 stories up across the street in Las Vegas, the guns had nothing to do with that, that it was a guy, it wasn't the gun, no. There's an element of truth. The gun didn't do it all by itself. It was a person, yes, but it wasn't a person with a baseball bat. It was a person with a gun. And not just a gun, but a high-powered, large magazine gun that's accurate at some distance, right? So we'll come back to this next week because this is an example, and as you know, not a hypothetical example, of a huge debate in our society that is a case where there's an element of truth in a claim which people then find completely compelling while ignoring the other side of the truth. There's a reason that the Army carries M16s, AK-47s, whatever you want to call them, and not baseball bats. There's a reason for that. So there are a whole bunch of things that people say that are partly true, and if you're highly motivated to be persuaded by the argument, you will accept the half of the statement that's true as settling the matter, and you will ignore the other half of the statement. Okay? Come back to that next week. Special pleading, cherry-picking the facts, also goes on all the time, I'm telling you. You'll have no trouble finding these species in the wild. Climate change isn't real. We just had a big cold spell. Really? So the senator shows up in the halls of Congress and makes a big snowball and says, ah, all those fools are talking about climate change. Look, we just had this massive snowfall and really a cold snap. Yeah? Do all the people that say climate change is real, we got to do something about it, go, you know what? You're right. It snowed. We were wrong. Tear it up. No, you can pick particular facts that are facts, but if you cherry pick them in a form of special pleading and act as though this particular fact overrides all the other relevant facts, that's a logical fallacy. This happens all the time. It happens all the time on climate change. It happens all the time on lots of it. Now, that doesn't answer the question, is climate change real or not? No, of course not. That's a question of induction from lots and lots of evidence. Reasonable people can disagree about some details. Yes, of course, that's true. Our purpose here is not to resolve the substance of these issues. Our purpose for the moment is to say these issues illustrate all the logical fallacies, all the illogical reasoning that goes on all the time in our culture. You see that? My point is not to persuade you anything about gun control, anything about climate change. It's not our point here. Our point is to say those issues provide a gazillion examples of logical fallacies and faulty reasoning, and people find them compelling. Begging the question, circular reasoning. She can't be trusted, so you shouldn't believe her. What? Begging the question is when you smuggle the conclusion into the premise, right? So she can't be trusted, therefore you shouldn't believe her. It's an entirely circular argument. I assert that she's not trustworthy, therefore you shouldn't believe her, but not being believable is just a part of what you mean by being untrustworthy, right? People do this all the time too. They smuggle the conclusion into the premises, and then they argue in entirely circular ways. And the false dilemma. You either have to favor a refugee ban or support the terrorists. What? What? Are those really the only two choices? Ban all refugees or you're in favor of the terrorists? When I was in Tuckerton two churches ago, the Christian Coalition, Ralph Reed's outfit, used to put out voter guides, and they were full of false dichotomies. And I won't even give you examples, but trust me, they were full of false dichotomies. Do you support this or that? And the that is always so awful that, of course, no right-thinking person would support that. So if you allow them to frame the question as it's either this or that, you must pick one, and that is so manifestly stupid or bad or wrong or harmful, then, of course, if you're not smart enough to see through what they're doing, you go, oh, no, I'm not for that. I must be for this. The logical fallacy is that it's a false dilemma. It's not this or that. There are a bunch of other things you could do. But for rhetorical purposes, people routinely pose false dilemmas. We got to do this or else it's going to be that. Well, maybe there are some alternatives. We're still going here. The post hoc, ergo propter hoc fallacy. Y happened after X, therefore X caused Y. You follow that? This happens, then that happens. This must have happened because that happened, right? Children, by the way, engage in this a lot. It's a logical fallacy that's very common in childhood. A child does something bad, mommy gets sick. The child believes that mommy got sick because she did something bad, right? I stole the cookie, mommy got cancer. Oh no, mommy got cancer because I stole the cookie. And I'm not making that stuff up. Children think that way because they're concrete reasoners and they haven't thought about how logic works. All they know is this happened and then that happened and they feel bad about this and that was bad, so they conclude this happened because of that. Okay? It's a very, very common fallacy. It's especially common among childhood. In fact, a whole lot of therapy, a whole lot of psychological therapy is helping people to see the fallacy of that. No, you didn't cause your mom to get sick. You didn't cause your parents to get divorced. You didn't cause this to happen. A whole lot of therapy is about dismantling the post hoc, ergo propter hoc fallacy. Equivocation is using the same words in a different sense. This is a pet peeve of mine up here, Lawrence Krauss. Larry Krauss is a very bright physicist and cosmologist at the University of, Arizona? Arizona State, what's it called? Arizona State University out there, out in Phoenix, where you guys go. Larry Krauss is a very prominent astrophysicist, cosmologist out there. And he wrote a book called A Universe from Nothing. And his thesis is that, you know, it's all but stated. His thesis is that, you know, religious people like the idea of a Big Bang because the idea of the Big Bang is there was nothing and then God brought something out of nothing, creation ex nihilo, that's called, out of nothing, right? So Larry Krauss writes this whole little book describing how, well, as a matter of fact, the universe can arise out of nothing because at the quantum level, there are virtual particles, there's a sort of quantum soup, don't worry about the details, there's a sort of quantum soup and particles come in and out of it, and in a sense, those things aren't real, but then sometimes they go into a massive inflation and they could even cause a whole universe. That's a really, really short description of a very prominent notion in physics these days. So Larry Krauss writes this whole book saying, aha, you can get a universe out of nothing, out of the quantum soup. I read that, and I know some science, and I thought, no, the quantum soup that you're talking about is not nothing. That's not the same thing that Augustine meant when he said God made something out of nothing. That's not nihil, that's the quantum soup. So I pondered this for a year or so, and then I had occasion to meet Paul Davies, who, by the way, is another cosmologist and astrophysicist whose office is right down the hall from Larry Krauss's, and I said, Professor Davies, isn't this an equivocation, an example of using the same word in two different ways? Nothing, when Augustine uses it, means nothing, literally nothing. When Larry Krauss uses it, he means the quantum soup. Those are two different meanings of nothing. The whole thesis of his book hangs on the equivocal use of that word, using it one way here and another way there. And Paul Davies said, yeah, sure. The whole book is one big mistake. right? Not that Krauss is wrong about his argument of how the universe arose. He's wrong in claiming it's an argument the universe arose from nothing in the sense that Augustine meant nothing. Paul Davies, who's not a religious guy but gets it, said, yeah, of course, Larry's just equivocating. So I just put that in there. Irrelevant expertise, Tom Cruise says. You hear this all the time, right? Matt Damon or Tom Cruise or, I don't know, Jennifer Aniston or somebody gets on and says something about some big issue. And you want to say, all right, Tom, Jennifer, what exactly is your expertise in this field? This happens all the time, too. The talk show host says, those morons, you know, talking about some sophisticated question of physics or science or cosmology or climatology. Those morons say this, ha, ha, ha. And you get your audience to chortle about how stupid those people are. What exactly are your qualifications for this, right? People will trot out celebrities. They'll trot out talk show hosts. They'll trot out the editorial page of their favorite newspaper to justify claims that are actually claims for experts. Well, what's the evidence here? What do the people that know what they're talking about say about this? But this irrelevant expertise gets cited all the time. Well, it said in this newspaper that, as if the editorial board of that newspaper was the best set of experts on whatever the question is at hand. People routinely do this. Why? Well, for a couple of reasons. There's tribal loyalty, again, subject for next week. It's easier. I sit down, what did the experts say about this? I don't even understand what the experts say. These people say this, those people say that. I have to spend a lot of time on that. I got to get to soccer practice. Much easier to go to the editorial page of your favorite journal or listen to your favorite TV or radio talk show host and say, well, he says this, so that must be the case. Well, maybe he has no expertise whatsoever. Maybe he's got other reasons to spout this line. So it's easy. People do it all the time. Democratic fallacy. This is not as opposed to like the Republican fallacy. This is democratic in the sense of the people. People are saying, right? Everybody says. Well, my experience with people are saying arguments involves two observations. Number one, when people come up to me and say, oh, people don't like this, what people usually means is I and my three friends. People often magnify their particular circle as if that represented the vox populi, the voice of the people, number one. And number two, even if what you say represents the vox populi, the voice of the people sometimes are wrong, right? So if you polled, let's say white slaveholders in Alabama in 1854, does God like slavery or not? All the people are saying, yeah, slavery is just fine with God. Slavery is God's idea. You might have 100% agreement on that among white slaveholders. Does that make it true? No. So the democratic fallacy, people are saying, a lot of people are saying this. First of all, a lot of people means me and my three friends or my tribe. And second, even if it's the entire society saying something, it might still be false. If you're going to settle the truth claim, you got to ask, what's the evidence, right? Not what are people saying. And the slippery slope argument, if we allow this, next thing you know, it's going to be that, right? Hear this all the time too, right? If you allow regulation about this thing, next thing you know, they're going to stifle your business and take away all your freedom. If you limit rapid-fire, high-powered rifles with magazines with 30 to 100 rounds in them, next thing you know, they're going to come steal your guns, right? If you permit people of the same sex to marry, next thing you know, what? Bestiality, right? I'm not making this stuff up. I've heard every single one of those arguments, and you've heard them too. But the slippery slope fallacy is we can't do this because some extreme thing that maybe nobody's even talking about will follow. Well, you don't know that it will follow. And if people are arguing for this thing and they're not arguing for that thing, presumably people can distinguish this thing from that thing. But the slippery slope argument is like the straw man. The straw man says, those people believe this stupid thing. The slippery slope argument is, this thing will lead to that stupid thing. The common denominator is to knock down something that nobody's actually claiming. In the straw man case, it's to knock down the proponent. In the slippery slope argument, it's to knock down the content. But in both cases, it avoids the substance of what's being proposed. Which brings us to hypocrisy. I need to find out who La Rochefoucauld is, but I like saying his name. La Rochefoucauld apparently said that hypocrisy is a tribute that vice pays to virtue. There are lots and lots of occasions for people to claim one thing and either not be seriously committed to that thing or to blame a tribe that is not theirs for something and give their own tribe a pass. Hypocrisy is pretending to be something other than what one is or to believe what one really does not believe. And double standards are a form of hypocrisy. So if that team, if blue team lies and cheats and steals and has conflicts of interest, then that makes blue team bad. If red team does the same thing, how does red team get a pass, right? The double standard that holds blue team accountable but not red team, that's a bad choice, isn't it? Green and yellow team is what I meant to say. Red team and blue team are actually army terms, right? If you go out and have a tank battle, you have red team and blue team. That's honestly, truly what I was thinking. So let's call it green team and yellow team, right? So hypocrisy is claiming we're for truth, we're for honesty, we're for fidelity, we're for responsibility, we're for... I'm going to stop because I get wound up. It's a good thing I'm not wound up yet. We're for these things. But then when somebody from my tribe does those things, suddenly we're not so concerned about those things. We claim that we're about those things. Truth, fidelity, honesty, balanced budgets, let's say. We're for those things. But then if my side violates those things, well, what we really care about is this. Arguably, that's hypocrisy. Now, I'm going to close on this, and I didn't allow any time for questions, sorry. Next week, hopefully, we'll get to that. Because next week, we'll talk about some controversial stuff as opposed to any of this. People will often accuse Christians of hypocrisy. They'll say, look, you people you come to church every Sunday, you talk about love, and you guys don't love each other. You know, you had slavery, you have segregation, you have racism, you have sexism, you have all kinds of oppressive stuff. You go to work on Monday and you cheat and you rip off your company and you treat your employees badly. You people are all hypocrites. Well, there's an element of truth. Is there hypocrisy in the church? Yes, of course. Of course. There are people who come on Sunday, piously listen to whatever, and then go out and do all kinds of bad stuff on Monday, or possibly even Sunday afternoon. Is that necessarily hypocrisy? Well, if you don't sincerely believe and try to live up to the things that you claim you believe, then yes, you're just a hypocrite. And 40-some years of being in churches, I believe there's hypocrisy in the church. But two things. Number one, it's not like religious people have a franchise on hypocrisy. It's not like non-religious people are not also hypocritical. That seems to be pervasive to the human condition. But there's also this, which is that failure to live up to one's standards is not necessarily hypocrisy. If we sincerely believe and strive to live up to those standards, failure might simply be sin. I absolutely believe we are to love our neighbors as ourselves. Am I really good at that? No. And at the risk of being presumptuous, I'm going to guess you're not really good at that either. Which is why we never say on Wednesday, when Jeannie's printing up the bulletin, should we skip the confession this week? Should we leave the prayer of confession out of the bulletin on the chance that nobody will have sinned this week? We think about that for, a second. And we say, nah, let's leave it in. The probability is very high that by Sunday, at least one person out there will have something to confess, right? Now, is that hypocrisy? I don't think so. If you have a problem with anger, let's say, and you're really trying to work on your anger and you know that that's a problem for you, or you have a problem with drinking, or you have a problem with envy, or you run down the seven deadly sins, if you have a problem with covetousness, you have a problem with lust, if you have a problem with pride, if you have a problem with anger, if you have a problem with any of those things, you may sincerely believe that those are sins, those are vices, those are things I don't want. I try to overcome those by the grace of God. It might just be sin. So when we say, love your neighbor as yourself, love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, are we hypocrites? No, we really do believe that. Are we any good at it? Not really. Are we trying to get better at it? Absolutely. If we're not trying to get better, if we don't really believe that, then yes, we're hypocrites. But if we're trying to be better, if we're trying to say, no, I envy that person, but I really don't want to be envious. I have interest in that person, but I shouldn't. That's wrong. Help me get over that. I'm tempted to this addiction, but I don't want to do that. Help me get over that. If we're sincere about those things, that's not hypocrisy. That's just sin. And our Christian faith tells us that God meets sin with grace and redemption, which is why you not only get sermons on Sunday, but you get a prayer of confession and you get an assurance of pardon. So, much as hypocrisy is pervasive in churches and outside of churches, religious people have no franchise on hypocrisy, not all failure to live up to standards is hypocrisy. Sometimes it's just sin. Good news, church lifts up not only the standards that God would have us live by, but the grace to forgive us when we fail, which is a predictable outcome, and the redemptive power of the Holy Spirit to help us do better. We're out of time. Come back next time. We'll talk about how lesser loyalties get in the way of our pursuit of truth. Thanks.